Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we begin the show by talking about the book Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi River Boat Captain. Lee Hendricks is our guest. He's a pilot, former river captain in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and he's worked on the river since the early 1970s and has written extensively about the Mississippi River, and I can tell you he's a good writer. As we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about the time maybe you've spent on the Mississippi River, or what questions you might have about the river. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Lee Hendricks, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Larry. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, looking forward to talking with you. I read your book over the weekend and really enjoyed it. And, you know, maybe just to start, the title is Peep Light, the subtitle, Stories of a Mississippi River Boat Captain. And maybe to begin with, what's a peep light? Talk about that for a minute.
So a peep light is a, on a tow, which could be 1,000 feet out from the boat, there's a metal pole out at the very bow of the tow with a flag on it, which is called the jackstaff. So during the daylight, the pilot can look at the jackstaff to see how the tow is swinging. At night, you can't see that jackstaff, so there's a little blue light there at the top of that jackstaff, and that is called the peep light.
And it sort of guides you in a way up the river.
Guides you physically, spiritually, emotionally, and in all different kinds of ways.
Well, your book opens with Clara Neipert and I agreed about this essay. It's one of our favorite essays. It's called Between the Sticks, and in that essay, you reflect on life on the river. What would you tell your younger self about his future working on the Mississippi?
Think about it before you do it the next time, Lee.
Oh, man.
What? No, I'm joking. But there have been times. I mean, it's one of the other stories. I say that every night I tell myself it's going to be the last night that I'm ever going to do it. And I still keep doing it. Been doing it for 51 years with a couple of short breaks in there a time or two.
Yeah. Well, here and now you've put this book together, which is really a collection of wonderful essays about your time working on boats on the river. So what's kept you on the Mississippi?
Oh, well, at first, I was not like the star quarterback in high school, or I wasn't the valedictorian of my class. I wasn't real popular with the girls or anything. So getting out there and having an adventure coming from that kind of an environment seemed like an escape, which was really, it was adventurous and daunting at the same time. But it was different. It was like I'd been transported into the middle of a cowboy movie, it was that spirit of adventure. The good part about being out there on that boat for 30 days or 45 days or however many days you could stand it was when you got off, you didn't have to go to work for another 30 days, so you could sleep in late for weeks. And that part I really liked. And then the money got to be pretty good. And when you're not spending any money on the boat, you can save a lot of money. And but there's a spiritual attachment undoubtedly about the river. I don't think I've tried other professions. I've snuck away from it for even months at a time, but I always seem like I want to come back. There's just something about the pull of it. As T.S. Eliot said, the strong brown God pulling you back into it.
Yeah. Well, you grew up near the Mississippi. Talk about that. And maybe first, what are the different zones of the river?
Wow. So basically, most people would say there's four. From Lake Itasca to the Twin Cities is one. It's more like a wilderness. You won't see any commercial traffic there. From the Twin Cities on down to St. Louis is the lock and dam part of the river, which most of the people around here are most familiar with. From the mouth of the Missouri River, which is right close to St. Louis, down to Cairo, where the Ohio comes in, is generally considered to be the mid-Mississippi. And then the lower Mississippi River is from Cairo down to the Gulf. Now, some people would put a fifth one in there, and I do in my book, called the combat zone, they call it, on the river, because there's so much traffic from Baton Rouge on down to the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah. So you grew up near the river. Did you get warnings about the river as a kid?
Yeah, my mom told me, whatever you do, don't go ever in it. She said it's a child abductor. It'll take you away, and your soul will be buried in the mud for an eternity. And if that won't get your attention, nothing will. But it was everything that I lacked. It was powerful and beautiful and free, and it was there for me. I just wanted to go out and give it a try.
Yeah. Well, you write about the other men and women who felt that pull of the river, too. One way you characterize life as a part of the towboat crew as lonely. Tell us about that.
Well, I like to, I think about it as the dangerous trilogy of danger, loneliness, and fatigue, which is out there all the time. There is probably no word in the English language that depicts the loneliness you have in the pilot house at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're by yourself and you still got all your thoughts. You're actually happier when there's something intense going on because it gets your thoughts away from things that people think about at 3 o'clock in the morning. If those of us that are up at 3 o'clock in the morning, like how your wife's doing, how your kids are doing, how your dog's doing, whether the bills are being paid, everything that human beings have to be concerned about. And you're up there alone in the pilot house with them, and your 15 or 30 barges or however many that you have, or all the people that you have when you're on board one of the passenger boats.
Tell us how you got the job on that first job on towboat. Your dad had some reservations about the whole affair, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, he had been in World War II, and he was convinced, and he had been on a small ship in the Pacific, and he was convinced that I'd be out there for a couple of days and just would be wanting to get home, because he said, you're going to be so lonely out there. They're not going to cook the food that you want, and you're not going to have your dog, and you're just going to be lonely out there. You really shouldn't do it. But I had a mind that I was going to give it a try, and so he took me down to the river, and then the boat was late. It didn't show up until 6 hours after they told me it was going to show up. And he kept coming back. He was hanging out in a tavern, and he kept coming back, and we'd drive around in the old 55 Chevy, and he kept trying to talk me out of it. And the last time, he just about had talked me out of it, and that's when the towboat showed up.
So
it was time. I've come to the crossroads. It's time to do it.
So describe a towboat for us. What do they look like?
A towboat has a square bow. The ones that you generally see on the river with the larger tows are from 140 feet long to 170. Now, down the lower, they'll be up to 200 feet long, and some of the smaller ones will only be maybe 100 feet long, but there's a variety of lengths, widths, or maybe 35 to 50 feet height. Top of the pilot house, maybe 50 feet. But the main characteristic that they have is the square bow with a couple of columns of metal on the bow, which are called Tonys. And that's not the name like Tony Bennett. That's two words, T-O-W-K-N-E-E. And those Tonys allow the towboat to face up, to attach itself to the barges, that they can push them down the river in sort of a large metal phalanx. Yeah. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. What about the living quarters on a towboat?
It depends. The first one I was on was rather challenging in that we only had one bathroom at the end of the hall. But that boat was built in 1947. They've improved considerably over the years. It's not like staying in the Hilton, but they tend to be comfortable and clean for the most part, if the crew's after keeping it well up. Some of the newer ones are even mounted on springs so that they don't bounce around quite so much. They don't jar your soul as you're trying to sleep like some of the older ones do.
You tell a funny story about, I think it was your first night, where it was so, you had to, of course, as the low person on the totem pole, you were down the probably in the worst quarters, and it was noisy and you didn't sleep much. But then you went up and talked to the captain or the pilot.
And so, yeah, I all that night I hadn't been able to sleep, and of course I was scared half to death. I thought I didn't know what was going on because I was a stranger in a strange land, and they kept running into things all night. I thought by accident, but as it turned out, it was like normal business about pushing barges and putting them into tow and that kind of a thing. And they had told me we were going up the Illinois River. And they woke me up that first morning, and I was made my way up to the pilot house. And I could see we were in an industrial area. And I thought, well, surely to God, in these 6 hours that they've been keeping me awake, bouncing me around, that we've gotten up to Peoria or someplace like that. And I asked the captain what city we were in, and he kind of looked at me like, well, if you ain't a dumb SOB, I guess you'll just have to do until a real one comes along. And he said, you from St. Louis, ain't you, boy? And I said, yes, sir. He said, you don't see your hometown when you see it go by you? And I realized that in that whole 6 hours, we had not even made it out of St. Louis. And I thought, what an arcane method of getting to the adventurous side of life I've gotten myself into.
Oh, man. Lee Hendricks, our guest today. His book is titled Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi River Boat Captain. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. Email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Trina LaSousa, our engineer today, Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking today with Lee Hendricks, author of Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi River Boat Captain, and having a lot of fun doing it. Again, if you have a question or comment, number to call 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Jim in Mauston emailed us and says, considering the bends on the Mississippi, how would you rate the bends at Lansing, Iowa, to from the west side in negotiating the Black Hawk Ridge?
That's a tough place. It used to be a lot worse because the channel above the Lansing Bridge used to go from one side to the other, about three or four different crossings. Now they've pretty much straightened it out, but that that turn right there at Lansing will get your attention, particularly the bridge. And used to sometimes do what's called a flanking maneuver there, but you had to be real careful when you backed up because you would have a tendency to do what's called overflank, and you could wind up setting down on that pier. I don't think I ever looked back on Lansing and thought I did a really good job. Actually, one time I got a buoy caught in a wheel there. It's a lot easier taking the American Queen down through there than it is Big Toe. But that's Jim, you hit a good one right there. That's one of the worst ones on the Upper Mississippi for sure.
And I think we have to at this time, you know, talk a bit about what you're pushing here. You're pushing these barges. They're around 200 feet long, and aren't they?
Yeah. So if you've got 15 barges, which often we would have had going down through there, that would be five lengths because they would maybe be made up five long and three wide to go through locks, and five lengths would be 1,000 feet. And 105 feet wide, and then each barge is about 1,400 tons of cargo if it's loaded. So it's a pretty big little mess of metal there.
Yeah, and, you know, 1,000 feet, what's that? If you think about a football field, you're pushing something over 3 football fields long down the river.
Yeah. Scares you to death, doesn't it? Just to think about it.
With the current,
even though I'm not doing it anymore.
With the current and everything else, and trying to maneuver, as Jim was asking about, bends in the Mississippi at Lansing, Iowa, it takes some skill. So kind of visualize something pushing something over 3 football fields long and the tons and tons of weight. And then trying to maneuver it. It's amazing. Arnold on the Menominee Reservation has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Arnold.
Hello. Yes, I wondered about what time of year would be the best time to view the entire river, and what would that cost?
So I'm assuming that what Arnold's talking about is taking like the American Queen and I work for American Queen now. I'll get that out of the way. So I'm a little prejudiced, but there's 3 different overnight passenger boats that are 3 different companies that you could take. So I'm assuming he's talking about one of those 3. I don't ever get involved in the money part of it. Nobody pays me other than my daily rate. So I don't get any kickback on number of passengers that we have. But the best time of the year, well, obviously, if you're going to go from the Twin Cities down to New Orleans, you're not going to want to do it in the winter, and probably not even in the springtime, because the water can get pretty high, and that can make it so we can't get underneath some bridges up in this part of the river. I would say late summer, early fall would be the best times to go.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking about those bluffs along the upper Mississippi and the colors as well. The sights you'd see along the shore would be really pretty at that time of the year.
Yeah, and even on the lower Mississippi, in low water, you get to see everything that's there, which is a real education because the Mississippi River is not a natural river anymore. It's pretty much controlled by man, specifically the Corps of Engineers. And you can see all the dikes and wing dams and all the revetment that's put in on the lower part of the river to keep the channel open. So that's a real educational tool, I think, for people to see all the, at least they know where their taxpayer dollars are going.
Arnold, thanks for calling. Ron in Duluth, Minnesota, we go to you. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I've just been hearing this summer about low water levels in Mississippi because of drought conditions. I just wondered, why wasn't some grain routed through the port of Duluth where it can go through the St. Lawrence Seaway if they had problems getting it down the Mississippi to the Gulf.
Kind of getting out of my purview there a little bit. Ron was the gentleman's name?
Ron, yeah.
I don't know too much about the Great Lakes, and I don't know about the business end of things so much about what's more economical way to ship things. I do know that from what I've been seeing, there's not a lot of grain traffic coming down the river right now, and I live in Lake City. And I'm seeing a lot of empty barges come down the river, which is very unusual for this type of time of year. So I'm assuming that either the harvest has been so bad that they're not shipping the grain, or because of the low water, that the rates are so high that people are looking for alternative ways to get the grain to market.
Makes some sense. Ron, thanks for calling in. Bruce, who's on the north shore of Lake Superior. Bruce, hi.
Hello. Say, gee, what a great program. And what I wanted to say, it's kind of anecdotal. So I was down a number of years ago boating on the Mississippi with my brother-in-law, who had just rebuilt a Chris craft. So we were going way too fast, and I looked ahead, and it was just totally black. And then I saw some light, and I went, Jim, we're heading right into a boat. And so he cut it, and we lived to tell the tale. But you guys are champs, and it's amazing when you get close to one of those vessels how big they are. So that's all I got.
All right, Bruce. Thanks.
Well, that's a good testimony. So y'all that are out there in those small boats, be careful, and particularly be careful if you had a few libations, because that's unfortunately that happens, that people don't. A lot of times I've heard people say that they think that the tow has stopped because it apparently is not relative to what kind of speed the small boat is making. It looks like we are stopped, or that the tow has stopped, but actually it's still making 6-7 miles an hour, and there's no brake pedal on that tow. So you can't stop it in a moment. You don't want to run over anybody for sure. But it has happened, and unfortunately, it will continue to happen. And folks need to know that they're in a tough environment out there, particularly the further down the river you go, down around New Orleans, down and through that part of the country. There's even much more traffic than there is around here.
Well, it's amazing. I was thinking about a guy that I guided on a fishing trip in northern Wisconsin once for muskies, and he was telling me about bass fishing on the Mississippi River, and he was bass fishing one time. It was I forget related. Anyway, he'd done it hundreds of times, but the fog dropped in on him. He wasn't paying attention. And suddenly, he couldn't see anything. He was in this heavy fog. And then he hears a foghorn. And he said he was so scared, he just started the boat. He didn't know what direction he was going, and went as fast as he could. And luckily enough, he hit the shore.
Better alternative than running into the tow, for sure. Well, you can imagine if you're in a very small boat and you can't see anything, then that guy's in that tow boat who's got 1,000 feet of tow out in front of him, he can't even come anywhere close to seeing out to his bow. So most tows these days, And this is up to the person, but most tows, at least on this part of the river, when it starts getting real foggy, they'll try to find a place to stop. But you can't always come to a good place to stop. You got to maybe make it a mile or two to to get to that place, and they don't have anchors. So you've got to find a, like your friend did, you got to shove into the bank, hopefully gently.
Steve in Stoughton, we'll go to you. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I have spent time at the power plants in Lansing and Cassville and Dubuque when they were burning coal. So I got to see a bunch of barge traffic and deliveries. But what amazed me throughout the years were the changes in the mayfly hatch. And it's my understanding that the mayfly hatch is an indicator of water quality. And I wonder what your guess thoughts on the mayfly hatch changes over time and water quality in general.
All right.
That's a great question. What was the gentleman's name again?
Steve in Stoughton.
Steve. Okay, Steve. One time, and this was back in the 1970s, I was at Lock 8 in Genoa, Wisconsin, and we were coming up the river with coal loads, and I knew there was a boat further up into what an area that we call Coon Slough. And I asked the guy where he wanted me to go to meet him. And he said, well, I'm not so sure that I'm going to make it out of this because I'm shut out. And usually when you say shut out, it's because of fog. And I looked out and I couldn't see any fog. I said, well, it's not foggy here. He said, no, I'm not shut out in fog. I'm shut out in bugs. And I thought he was joking with me at first until I started up the river and I got into the area that he was in. And even with these very powerful searchlights that we have, I couldn't see but one or two buoys out ahead of me. And unfortunately, later that night, it started to rain and these we called them mayflies. I don't know why they're called mayflies. They never come out in May. It's always June or July. And these things were like a Stephen King novel. They were dripping from the top of the pilot house in these large globs. Looked like they would just swallow you alive. And I used to see a lot more of them. This year, we brought the American Queen up. And there was a few on the side of the boat, but nothing like we had seen previously. The deck crew was complaining, and I said, well, y'all ain't seen nothing yet. Wait till they bring the snow plows out to get them off the roads. And everybody thought I was joking, but no, it's those of us who live up here and know, and Steve seems to know for sure, that they actually used to be a lot worse. So I am certainly no expert on bugs, other than I know they're kind of a pain in the butt to wipe off the boat. But I have heard that they are a barometer of the health of the river, and if that's true, then the river might not be as healthy as it was 15, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think he's got a good point there.
Steve, thanks a lot for calling. One great story from your book, and there were many great stories in your book. I enjoyed them all. But one that caught my eye and I wanted to mention was titled Lock on the Head. It's about the time you went through a lock with Smokey and Freddy. And you talk about those guys a bit.
So you asked me once, you know, about what kept me coming back on the river. And I suspect it's like with a lot of people. It's the relationships that you make. And I have so many deck crew that, we bonded like a family. We were part of each other, and that's the kind of a relationship that you were really, that's like your ideal part of your relationship, an ideal relationship you would have with these other people, that you would be responsible for them. They would have your back and you would have theirs and live together through anything. And then when they get off the boat and you hear something that has bad happened to them, it hurts. It hurts like it's a person in your family.
It sounded to me as I read it like a perfect fit for something like the Moth Radio Hour. have you ever done one of those types of things or read that the chapter publicly?
I'm sorry, what radio again? I didn't catch
the, the Moth radio hour, where people get on and tell a little 5-minute or 7-minute story. You may be or may not be familiar with it, but I just wondered if you've ever done something like that or read that chapter aloud to folks.
No, I haven't. And I'm really glad you like that one. That's one of my favorite stories. It's a little bit longer, but I think it gives you an idea about the bonding that you have with the people that you're out there on the river with, because it's like, you're not just working together. You're living together. You're eating together. You're with each other for, you know, 24 hours a day, and you have to come to terms with learning how to be with those folks.
Everybody's idiosyncrasies. Yeah, absolutely. I know you wanted to share a little about the history of commerce along the Mississippi, and maybe walk us a bit through that timeline.
So, yeah, of course, the first boats on the river were canoes. Native Americans, indigenous people, had trade networks set up before any Europeans came here. And, of course, the Europeans, when they first came, they used the same type of a craft. But then it evolved into flat boats and keel boats, flat boats being basically a one-way commerce where they could only go down the river. Keel boats, you could coax them back up the river, but it's hard work. Then in the 1800s, 1811, the first steamboat, the New Orleans, was taken down the Ohio River and the Mississippi Rivers, and that ushered in the age of steamboats. In the 1840s, on the Ohio River, they started converting some of what they called packet steamboats into towboats, only they would take the barges, coal barges, alongside the boat rather than push out in front. And it wasn't until the early part of the 20th century that the modern day towboat, the one that actually pushes barges out in front of it, came into vogue. And then that slowly morphed into the diesel power towboats that we have on the river today. I do have one of my stories in that book gives a more detailed account of that, but that's a brief sketch about that. And then, of course, the passenger industry is completely different game there too. You don't have what we used to call, or what they used to call, packet boats, which were steamboats that had cargo and passengers. Now the passenger boat industry is a separate industry of its own.
Yeah. And there was competition. The railroads came in, and that was another time when there was a bit of competition and not always nice, I guess, between the railroads and those shipping on the water.
Well, I guess the first instance of that was the bridge in Rock Island, railroad bridge that the steamboat called the Effie Afton had a collision with and sued the railroad, and Abraham Lincoln was one of the lawyers defending the railroad, and it kind of degenerated from that to where the rail river commerce and train commerce always haven't always had the most amicable of relationships, although they could really help each other out in a perfect world, but most of the time people don't look at it that way. They seem to want to be in a contentious relationship, and there was a lot of hard feelings about some of the new locks. Well, even all the locks that got put in on the upper Mississippi River in the 1930s, they had a bonding between the railroads and environmental people to try to subvert that so that the locks never got put in. And that still to this day, anytime the Corps of Engineers wants to build a new lock or make a big improvement, they have to run up against railroads and environmental groups as well.
You tell a funny story about Lock 23, I think it is.
Lock 23, right, yeah. So when I've kind of left the piloting part of my career temporarily. I work as what's called a river Lorian on the American Queen, which is a lot easier work. And I was asked the first night out of St. Louis, I asked the guests, who stayed up to see Lock 23? And if somebody raises their hand, I say, well, you're a bigger liar than I am, because there is Lock 23. 23 got left out.
So they just skipped that.
Well, yeah, there was plans to actually put it in, but they decided that they didn't really need it because 22 and 24 are so close together. And to make up for it, you have 5 and 5A. So go figure.
Oh, man. Lee, you have written a fascinating book. I want to thank you so much for writing it. I know some of the chapters of that or portions of it appeared in Big River Magazine. Reggie McLeod, I'm sure, is an old friend of yours. And I really enjoy the book, and I hope a lot of people read it. Thank you, Lee, very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Larry. I appreciate it. And thanks to the callers for showing interest in my life's work.
Yeah. Lee Hendricks, and I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody who called in, but that such is the nature of this particular job. Lee Hendricks, an author, pilot, former river captain in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and his book is titled Peep Light, Stories of a Mississippi River Boat Captain. Well, we've been in the water. Let's go up in the air a bit and talk about a movie that many of you have seen probably more than once. The title of the movie is Airplane, and the three directors are with me next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.